Hello, friends, and welcome to the BMA Audio Blast, where literature, arts, statecraft, and transformation converge, with Jason Brown and Emily Edelman. On this episode, the first of six segments, we talk with David Rothstein, the owner and operator of the Music Inn in Lenox from 1970 until 1979. He states on the website of the Music Inn archives, "Music Inn was the last outpost of the counterculture, which had evolved as a result of the groundbreaking evolution of jazz as the first integrated music genre that ultimately paved the way for rock and roll."
I just want to briefly read some of the amazing schedule from 1970 through 1978. July 4th, 1970, Arlo Guthrie, the 11th, Delaney and Bonnie, 12th, Ike and Tina Turner, 18th, Muddy Waters and B.B. King. Wow. August 2nd, James Taylor. 1971, July 3rd, Pete Seeger. 10th, Muddy Waters. 24th, Delaney and Bonnie. 31st, Birds and Ravi Shankar. And then after that, from like 1972 on, you had Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Mahavishnu Orchestra, Randy Newman, Taj Mahal, Tom Rush, Joan Baez, Van Morrison, Judy Collins, Richie Havens, Bonnie Raitt, Lou Reed, Chick Corea, and Weather Report. America, this is 1974, Shanana, Eagles, Herbie Hancock, and Larry Coryell. Oh man. Bruce Springsteen, Hot Tuna, Fats Domino, The Band, Jimmy Cliff, Herbie Hancock, Jimmy Buffett, and all these people appear a couple of times.
David, welcome. So you said, if you were there, you don't remember, and if you remember, you weren't there.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, it means I was there, so I don't remember.
So you don't remember anything?
No, because, well, what happened was in the good old days, in the 50s, Music Inn started and concerts were in a courtyard, under a tent in a courtyard. But when we restarted in 1970, had this idea of just putting the stage out of the courtyard down on the field. It was just a temporary thing. And we didn't have a fence around the field. And so I remember going down to town hall and borrowing a couple of rolls of snow fence from the town. You know, they don't seem to use it anymore, but those about 2 feet high, maybe 3 feet high, made of slats of wood held together with wire and put it up to keep the wind from blowing snow across the road and forming a deep drift. So we put some snow fence up around the front of the field so people thought there might have been a fence around it. And I remember Pete Seeger the first year or so. He was absolutely outraged. He was so upset that we were ripping people off. We were charging $3 to get in. And
working man's musician.
Right. And remember, this was 1970. Woodstock was 1969. So this was just another, this was a little overlap of Woodstock. And so we didn't want beer on the field. People did bring a little bit, but they weren't drinking, but they might have gotten high. Well, then they wouldn't remember. And so if you were there, you wouldn't remember.
Oh, I love it.
If you remember, then you obviously weren't there because you were conscious.
Do you recall the first time you saw the grounds?
Yeah, I came up in a February blizzard from Philadelphia. Maybe in 68 or 69, I can't remember exactly, probably 68. And I mean, in those days, winter was really winter. The drifts were, 5 feet deep or 3 feet deep. And I had never been to Lenox or Stockbridge. And I drove up from Philadelphia and I got to the entrance of Music Inn and long driveway up the hill, drove up and saw some amazing old buildings, all empty, because it had been closed down or abandoned several years before. And I sort of wandered through the buildings of the old stable that had been made into a hotel. They took the horse stalls and they became the hotel rooms. And then there was the Ice House and the Carriage Barn, which had become a kind of a theater for the old school of jazz. And then there were a couple of other, farmhouse was there. And then the Potting Shed, which was way off on the other side of the field, had been a very fashionable restaurant in its heyday. But all the buildings were vacant, and amazing buildings for a farm. It was the farm complex for the Wheatley estate, but the farm buildings had all been designed by the same architect, Peabody and Stearns of Boston, who had designed the mansion. And so they were, as an architect, they were evoking uses in my mind. And so I looked around, I drove around, I checked out the town back and forth. And the reason I even came there was my cousin, who had a place in Lenox and was restoring Blantyre, which was another one of the main, the mansions, the cottages, into a very, very fancy hotel. And he had called me up and said, "Dave, come up and look at this place and tell us what we can do with it." And so I did, and I went back to Bob, and I said, "Bob, it's awesome, but I don't know that there's anything we can do with it. There's no zoning, there's no financing, there's no market, there's no this, there's no that." It was, you know, a quarter of a mile from Tanglewood, so that was where he thought the potential might be. But then he turned around and said, "Okay, well, we'll buy it anyway." 'Cause 60 acres of, you know, seven buildings on 60 acres on the Stockbridge Bowl next to Tanglewood has to be worth something, I guess. He had some partners, and they just dialed me in and said, "Okay, Dave, do something with it." So that was the venture.
So the architecture of that venue, the performance venue, was all you. That you see in the photographs.
The architecture
was designed by you.
Well, there wasn't much to design. It was all pre-existing buildings that we used. Yeah, we maybe modified them over the years. No, to do something with it meant find somebody to use it. It had been a hotel. It had been a famous music center. It was the first summer jazz festival in the country, and the first theoretical school of jazz.
And Ornette Coleman came in?
Everybody. That's another whole history to go back.
Well, he was a student. Ornette Coleman was one of the students.
The school of jazz was a school for jazz musicians of the day to understand what jazz was, to understand what they were actually doing. It started in the 1950s at Music Inn. Stephanie Barber was the person who started it all. And in 1960, she bought the mansion back from the symphony, who it had been given pretty much to the symphony in 1950, so to use for student housing. And then by 1960, Stephanie bought the mansion. She sold the Music Inn to Don Silveiro. She moved the School of Jazz to the mansion, and where it flourished for quite a few years. Modern Jazz Quartet was the house group.
And
every jazz person of any note was there in some for one summer or another.
So the teachers were John Lewis, right?
The teachers were all the jazz people teaching themselves what the hell is this jazz that we're doing. We have a wonderful documentary film about that era, and I'd like to package that in the program. It was done by my son Casey, Ben Barinholtz, George Schuller, Gunther Schuller's son, and Ben Barber, Stephanie Barber's stepson.
Yeah, look for that on YouTube. Yeah.
It's online. It's online on Vimeo. It needs a password, which I think I can find.
I need the password.
The password is either Mahalia Jackson or Stephanie Barber. Yeah, we'll dig it up. We'll find it.
See that? Wow.
No, but to go back a little bit to in the history, it started around 1950, because like many of those cottages, which the mansions in the Berkshires were called cottages, but they were basically mansions, were built by the oligarchs of the day in the 1890s, the Vanderbilts, the Westinghouses, the Carnegies, and on
the
and
Gilded
on.
Age, yeah.
And by the 1920s and 30s, they were abandoned, and they were available for sale, and nobody wanted them. You couldn't find a buyer. And Wheatley, that's why Tanglewood's here. Now, who wants this piece of property? We can't. We'll give it to somebody. We'll give it to Tanglewood. Maybe they can use it. Wheatley was one of the last owner-occupied of the cottages, and when it came up for sale in the early 1950s, the real estate agent was Stephanie Barber, trying to find a buyer. And she couldn't find a buyer, so she sold it, the mansion, to the Symphony, thinking that maybe they could do something with it. And she couldn't find a buyer for the farm, which was another 60 acres overlooking Stockbridge Bowl. So she bought it, thinking she would make a hotel, for a summer hotel, and people going to Tanglewood might be her customers, but it didn't work out. So she went down to New York, and she got Louis Armstrong to come up and entertain, and that was the beginning of the jazz festival, and it blossomed over the years.
I saw a picture of Billie Holiday. Into the archives. I can't believe she was up here.
Everybody.
Yeah.
And then when she sold it to Soviero, he continued it. He hasn't gotten much history notice, but he continued the concerts and continued the music in, and actually was taking it higher. Got to the point where Ray Charles was going to buy it.
Yeah.
And
it was going to be a drug rehabilitation center.
For black musicians, a rehab center for black musicians was one idea. But then all of a sudden, Soviero abandoned everything. I think some involvement with a Rayette that might have been Ray's Rayette. And I found Soviero years later had a major cooking school in Todi, Italy. He was a master chef, and the Potting Shed became a very, very exclusive Italian restaurant. that's when it became vacant, right after Soviero left.
You have been listening to the BMA Audio Blast's first of six segments with David Rothstein, talking about the legend of Music Inn in the Berkshires. And now, a word from our sponsors. Take it away, Professor.
Oh, am I on now? Okay. Brought to you by Elizabeth's Fine Candies, making sure your type 2 diabetes is one step closer every day. And clear-cut real estate, where no tree is ever left behind. And Pognositron AI, making all your hard work better. Just leave your mind at home.
Remember, every small act of kindness and understanding contributes to a greater harmony on Earth. Thank you for joining us today.
The BMA Podblast is the sole creation of Berkshire Media Artists. All rights reserved.